You're listening to On the Vine, a podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by IvyHoopsOnline.com.
Greetings to you all from the new Ivy Hoops Online headquarters in Berkeley, California, which makes no sense. It's time for another season of Ivy League basketball. A long summer has come to an end, and on Friday, the action kicks off once again on the hardwood. And we here at On the Vine will be here all season long to bring you, well, what I believe is the only podcast about Ivy League basketball. We're the team from Ivy Hoops Online. I'm your host, Peter Andrews, as always, and we are joined by an excellent panel tonight. First, as always, my co-host, Mike Tony, the editor of the site. Mike, how's it going?
Great, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing good. I was expecting you to say you were fantastic, but
I'm a little rusty. I was hearing stuff in my headphones, and frankly, I'm just very rusty after 8 months off. So, I am fantastic. I hope you are too on the West Coast, Peter Andrews.
Thank you. We're also joined by the founder of Ivy Hoops Online. He goes by Bruno Marsh sometimes, but his real name is Ian Halpern. Ian, how's it going?
Going well, Peter. Good to be back. Excited for a wide open new 2015-16 season.
We're joined by the person who knows more about Princeton basketball than anyone I have ever met. He goes by Toothless Tiger, but his real name is George Clark. George, how's it going?
Great, Peter. It's wonderful to be with all of you guys. I'm looking forward to one of the best seasons of Ivy League basketball in recent memory.
I think we all are as well. And rounding out our panel tonight, you might know him as a guy who makes a lot of Photoshops with Matt Olo's face. It's Sam Tidings. Sam, how's it going?
It's going very well for me, Peter. Thank you for having me on.
I'm pretty sure that you've never been introduced like that before.
It's a first time for everything.
Well, let's get right into it. I think what George said is totally accurate. For the first time in years, we have a completely and utterly wide-open situation at the top of the conference. In the preseason media poll, there were first-place votes for three different teams, 5 votes for Yale, although they did actually get first place in the poll, 6 votes for Columbia, and 6 votes for Princeton. No votes for reigning 4- or 5-time champion Harvard Crimson. So we'll get to all of those teams in turn, but let's start with the team at the top of the poll, which is the Yale Bulldogs, who last year were basically 2 seconds away from their first trip to the NCAA tournament in decades, inexplicably falling at Dartmouth in the final seconds, last game of the season, and then coughing up a playoff to the aforementioned Harvard team. So I'm going to start by asking this to Ian, two-part question. One, how on earth do you come back from that? And more specifically, how do you come back from that without the services of Javier Durant?
Well, suffered a little PTSD there 10 seconds ago as you ripped through that summary of the end of last season, but I'm okay now. The Yale Bulldogs are okay now. Justin Sears is back. Jack Montague is back. No Duran, but Brandon Sherrod, Whiff and Poof, World Tour extraordinaire, is now a senior, and he's back on the team. There's some good young talent in New Haven, and plenty of reason to be optimistic about this season. The league is wide open. 4 seniors who were a part of last year's team, great careers are now gone. The only positive to them being gone is that, less carryover from the traumatic end to last season. But there's, James Jones, his teams are always in the top half. This team hopefully will do better than top half. Any analysis of the Bulldogs' chances this year has to start, of course, with Player of the Year, Justin Sears. I think that he has the opportunity here to lead Yale to that promised land that they came so, so close to reaching last season.
Sam, you and I were actually talking earlier about Justin Sears, who in a ranking of the top 100 players of college basketball earlier today, was listed but not ranked in that top 100 behind Columbia's Matt Olow, who, trust me, we will get to. But I was wondering if I could get your thoughts. Do you think on sort of, is there a reason why Justin Sears doesn't get as much respect around the country? Should he be more recognized as sort of the dominant player in the league right now?
Well, to an extent, I think it's surprising when anyone from the Ivy League gets that sort of national recognition. So the fact that Mauro's been on the SB Nation Top 100 and the CBS Sports Top 100, it's really interesting to me that he's been on both of those and Sears hasn't. I think part of what we were discussing earlier was that, well, Sears is bigger. Most Ivy League forwards are not so big, so it's easier for him to put up points as opposed to a guy like Lowe, who can sort of translate his game as a guard, you'd think, more seamlessly to a Power 5 team.
Mike, what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, Justin Sears definitely seems to be flying under the radar in contrast to your life crush, Matt Olow. It's really, I mean, yeah, Lowe is getting all the player to watch accolades, most recently that SI list from today. But it's really, you know, talking about Yale, redemption is, you know, as sappy as it might seem, it is a powerful motivator not to be discounted when talking about a competitor like Justin Sears, who posted 53 points and 21 rebounds and 2 wins over Princeton and 28 points in another win over Columbia last year. So, you know, even without Javier Duran, this is a team that is built around what Sears can do at both ends of the floor, you know, in terms of providing solid interior defense, getting to the foul line. I don't think any of that will change this season. It's just a matter of, you know, this Yale squad lost 3 of its top 5 scorers from last year. So where is that scoring going to come from? It's not guaranteed. So if you ask, well, then why was Yale ranked 4th in the Ivy League in SI's ranking of all 351 Division I teams? Well, that's why. First of all, nobody really has a good handle on exactly how the top half of the league is going to shake out, and Javier Duran's a hugely consistent presence who is gone now. So you've got that, but having said all of that, at least with Yale, you've got a team that is more balanced than Princeton and Columbia. When you look at their two-way players, you look at their roster, they don't have a porous defense. And, yeah, I mean, don't discount Justin Sears. I'm sure, like the entire Princeton basketball program, Justin Sears is also happy to be flying under the radar right now.
Ian, from your perspective, who should we be looking at as a player who is going to take a big leap forward this year?
It's a good question. I think you can make the argument that last year it was Jack Montague who came up some huge clutch shots, including that corner three to beat UConn and maybe the Ivy League's biggest win of the season, almost definitely the biggest win of the season. So I'd look for him to have an even more expanded role. And then also Makai Mason, another guard who in his freshman year ended up seeing about 45% of his team's minutes. And that number is definitely going to go up again. As you said, one of the key things here is going to be replacing the production of Javier Duran. And it's gonna have to come from a lot of guys. I don't think any one player is going to be able to fill that void. So I'd look to some of the new younger freshmen. To be honest, I don't think we'll know until the first couple non-conference games who James Jones is going to trust. Because it's always tough as a freshman to crack that rotation. Jones likes to favor his upperclassmen early in the season.
It'll be interesting from my perspective to see. You mentioned Makai Mason, and I've in the couple games I saw him play last year against Columbia, I was not particularly impressed with his defense in particular. I thought he had a really hard time dealing with not just Mauro Lowe, but sort of the other guys who came on around him. So obviously defense, a lot of the times, the second half of the equation with these teams. But
for sure,
have to step it up.
I think the speed of the league, the speed of Division I basketball, is the hardest part for some of these freshmen to come in and understand quickly. The fact that you have to play both sides of the ball 110% every minute you're in the game, I think that's something that comes with a year of experience, and I think hopefully that's something that Mason will have a more of a grasp on this year.
Yeah, and maybe the foot speed wasn't there with Mekhi Mason, but he had great flashes. He was very tough in the playoff game against Harvard at the Palestra last year, and he went 5-for-5 from the field, 11 points at Jadwin in a win against Princeton last season. So we've seen, yeah, maybe the foot speed and some of the intuition wasn't there in his freshman year, but I would expect Mekhi Mason to step up in a big way because, number one, he's going to have to, and number two, he did show the flashes of more than adequacy, more than freshman adequacy, that he probably can translate that into something this year.
And one thing it will be interesting to see for every team is how each coach adjusts to the new 30-second shot clock rule this season. Obviously, that's a big new development. I want to turn from Yale over to Princeton, who I think has a bit of a different way of playing the game than the Bulldogs do. Every player on that team has a role to play, and they often seem to struggle in non-conference and then turn into a bizarrely unstoppable juggernaut once they hit the Ivies. So let's turn to George, and I want to get your take on where the Tigers are at heading into the season.
Someone described Princeton as mechanical recently, and I think it might have been our dear editor who came up with that adjective, and I resent that.
No, that was Peter.
Oh, is it? Oh, excuse me, Peter.
When did I say that? I have literally no memory of saying that.
it was in your program rundown, Peter.
I would suggest that their movements are far more poetic than mechanical.
refers to a sense of inevitability more than, I guess, a roboticness. But you can take it however you
want. All right, I'll accept that. That's fine. But this is a season, the first season in the Henderson era in which Princeton is generally considered to have a realistic shot at winning a championship. And there's the biggest reason is we've got 6 of the first 8 people coming back, 5 starters, excuse me, and we finished the year on a little strong note. Of course, we withstood Motto Lowe's 37-point outburst at Jadwin last year and came back from a 6 or 7 point deficit in the last couple of minutes. It's really showed how far I think that team had come to that point, and I think this year they're going to build out on the way they finished last season. The key is how well Amir Bell can handle point guard duties as a freshman. He played over his head much of the year. He obviously played as a freshman frequently enough to demonstrate that he needed to mature, and I think he has. His staff is very, very high on him coming into this year with Spencer Weiss and Stephen Cook. Pardon me, gentlemen, I haven't felt well in several days, but those two guys as juniors really complement each other very well. We've got Pete Miller in the middle, who will not be called upon to score very much, but he's shown that he can defend and he can rebound, and he scores inside quite well when given the opportunity. So there are a lot of positives for this Tiger team coming into the season, and I think the path to the championship or to a title for Princeton is you got to get to 10 wins to be in the conversation, and they can do that if they split with Harvard, Yale, and Columbia. They can get to 10-4 by sweeping the other people. 10-4, I think, would be in the conversation. I think 11-3 at worst is a tie. and there may well be a three-way tie. I think the distinction between the first division and the second division is far clearer this year, more distinct than ever, even though I think the other teams have a chance to be competitive at times. The top four teams, it seems to me, are going to be pretty solid in the first division. Problem Princeton's had historically under Henderson is that they haven't been able to compete with Harvard and Yale. Henderson is 4-12, I think, against those two teams in 4 years, and two of those wins came in the first season. Last year, Princeton lost 5 games, 4 of them to Harvard and Yale, and one on the road inexplicably, giving up a double-digit lead in Ithaca in about 6 minutes in the second half. So if they can split with Harvard, with Yale, and Columbia, it seems to me they have a real good chance to go 11-3. And they even have room for another loss to go 10-4. I think it's highly unlikely that any team is going to run the table to get to 12 wins. I think that's just not in the cards. So I think that the Tigers have a real shot at being in the last week, and who knows what can happen.
The tricky thing about the Ivy League that we remember every year is that with the schedule of back-to-backs, with the difficulties of travel, and I think the way in which the whole league's levels have come up over the years, those games are not gimmies. Talk about sweeps over teams like Dartmouth, Penn, Brown. Certainly doable, but not necessarily inevitable. I want to ask, you know, Ian, Mike, Sam, any thoughts on the Tigers' outlook for this year?
Well, something that Kevin Whitaker of Big Apple Buckets pointed out in our Tea Leaves Roundup that's going to run tomorrow, and George astutely observed as well in his season preview that's also going to run, is that Mitch Henderson with this season is now the longest tenured Princeton coach since Pete Carril. And that just so happens to coincide with a down year for Harvard and all his players being his recruits now, with a stacked backcourt. So this is going to really say a lot about him as a coach, almost a referendum-type season, if you will, where this program's pulse is. Clay Wilson said he'd like to see, and this will be published tomorrow as well, he'd like to see Hans Bryce, he's most effective when he's in attack mode and inside the arc. And actually, 10 out of 14 Ivy games last season, he shot 33.3% or less from downtown. So, you know, maybe offensively, he should use his size and skill more in the paint, maybe challenge some of these teams with weak interior defenses like Columbia. I think Princeton has the experience, they've got the backcourt, they've got the depth, a very long bench. It's going to equip them well. The smart money seems to be on Princeton to win it all this year, and all you need to do is take a look at that backcourt with Weiss, Cook, Bell, Caruso, maybe off the bench. Any one of those could be potentially all-Ivy status this year. You know, it's looking pretty good for Princeton if they can hold to expectations.
Well, I agree with that, Michael. And I think to Peter's point about back-to-backs, of course, it's a nightmare for everybody in the Ivy League. And I don't think the public at large has an appreciation of how difficult it is to play back-to-back 4 times in a season. But with the depth that the Tigers have and the experience that they have, it seems to me they're better equipped to withstand or to get through those tough back-to-backs. Because if one or two guys is off, somebody else may not be. And there's a lot of quality, 8 people deep. That's very important. And Brace was the key to the end of the season because he's played with an aggression over the last couple of weeks last year that everyone was wondering, where in the world has that been? So I think he worked as hard as anyone in the off season. Of course, with Mauro Loh, they both played a lot in Europe and Germany, in the German national program this year, both of them. had great summers, and I think both of them are really going to have great years. I hope Lowe could be clearly the player of the year. We'll talk more about him in a few minutes.
Yes, I apologize for mispronouncing Ross's last name. I was trying to hold back a sneeze, Peter.
All right, that sounds good. Let's then actually move on to the other team floating around there. Got 6 first place votes, finished second in the power poll for the first time this year. I can only assume, Sam, it's because Corey Osikowski is no longer on the Columbia Lions. No, I don't think that's what it is. It's the return of Alex Rosenberg and Grant Mullins, who missed both of last year with an injury, various injuries. They're now coming into their senior seasons, where they're going to be joined by Kyle Castlin, who's now a sophomore this year, wing player, and of course, as previously mentioned, Maudo Lowe, who put together a sterling campaign last season, getting a lot of talk as someone who is a player to watch, not just in the Ivy League, but in all of college basketball. So I'll start, Sam, to you. What is the key to getting Alex Rosenberg and Grant Mullins back into this team?
Key, I think, is defensively for them. That we know that, you know, if Rosenberg or Mullins has an off night shooting the ball, that Lowe has established himself last year and even the year before, a guy who can create his own shot, a guy who can find a way to get open, a guy who can make three-pointers at a prolific rate, so that if they're struggling on offense, there's a guy they know they can defer to. And then Mullins and Rosenberg shouldn't feel the need to try to take over and, you know, be 20-point scorers every night. Not that Mullins was necessarily that guy in the first place, but separate issue. I think defensively, if, and it's a huge if, because Columbia's defense was so bad last year, and that was before, and that was even without Alex Rosenberg, who wasn't really a great defender in his own right when he was, you know, on the floor. If he can lock down stretch fours, if he can, you know, bang in the post, grab some rebounds, hold off the guys like Hans Brace, he needs to play the five even. If he can be even average defensively this season coming back for Columbia with the way he plays offense, that this team could be a juggernaut.
The other question with that defense is about the front court. You mentioned getting Alex Rosenberg in there. I joked about losing Corey Osikowski, but you are losing your five, who's giving you 20 minutes a night. Lions front court looks like this. The returning juniors are Jeff Kobe, who's more athletic, a little undersized. Luke Petrasek, very big, has had trouble staying on the court. Connor Voss, even bigger. No discernible evidence of basketball skills as of yet from him. And you're also getting in two freshmen who are pretty big in Shane Eberle and Dirk Jr., Lucas Meisner. So, Sam, your thoughts on... That's a lot of bodies and filling, and we don't know how much we're going to look at Rosenberg at the four, how Smith is going to deal with this. If you were Kyle Smith, how would you look at putting this front court together?
I think it's sort of a front court that, you know, you can play with a little bit. I really do not want to compare this Columbia basketball team to last year's Golden State Warriors. But
you're about to.
But I'm about to that, you know, you have different lineups for different situations. If you need to go super big, you can play a lineup with Voss at the 5, Petrasek at the 4, Rosenberg at the 3. If you need to go super small to match up with teams, you can play Rosenberg at the 4 or 5 and Castlin at the 3 and Maudo at the 2. They need to be, Smith especially needs to be amenable to playing small ball. That's something he hasn't really wanted to do since he came to Columbia. And I think that's been reflected in the pace that Columbia plays at in conference and out of conference. And I think that also to an extent, I mean, we were talking about this a couple week or so ago, that there's a lot of minutes and this team is really, really deep. And so it's going to be a struggle for Smith to keep his guys happy, to keep them healthy, especially the ones coming off of injuries, especially the freshmen who don't play back-to-backs in high school very often, who don't play the grueling of a schedule. It's going to be a real juggling act for Smith.
Yeah, I think that...
My feeling on that, excuse me, and let me jump in here.
You got it, Joe.
I think Columbia can be very, very good, even if Rosenberg is average defensively, because frankly he is average defensively and I don't think he's going to be that much better. The thing about Columbia has to get some contribution from somebody we don't know too much about yet. I know a lot about everybody at Princeton who's going to play because they're all veterans. Somebody at Columbia needs to step up, and may very well, the Dirk Jr. may be the real deal. If he is after the preseason, if he's able to step in during the league and contribute 10, 15 minutes, quality minutes, then that juggernaut may very well be in the making. But Columbia is going to need a lot of help from somebody that we don't know anything about yet, whereas really Princeton does not. Princeton has to get Princeton's those eight players have to play at the same level or perhaps in some cases a little better than they did last year, and they'll be fine. Columbia just has some unknowns, but I wouldn't bet against them. Smith does a great job.
I agree with all of that. I think the depth of this team is scary. Peter, I got a trivia question for you. There were four players last year on the Columbia Lions that shot over 40% from three. Can you name them?
Well, one's Mauto Low.
Mauto shot 42% on 189 attempts. That's insane. That's one.
Off the charts. The others are going to be must be totally random. I know Chris McComber took a lot of threes, wasn't very good. I'm going to guess Kyle Castlin is one.
So Castlin is actually not one, and I was expecting him to be one. He shot 39%, so I think he's going to replace a lot of those shots this year. But the next one was your boy Stevie Frankowski.
That's right.
42%.
And
then the last
one?
The last two are still around.
Wow. It's not like Kendall Jackson, is it?
Kendall Jackson is correct. 41%, 9 for 22. Maybe he'll get more shots this year.
Seems unlikely. When you look at the I actually do want to just pause and say the depth at point guard is going to be a real question for Columbia because you've got Isaac Cohen coming back who
has
the ball so much, and he's a backup now. I have no doubt he's not going to start.
Yeah.
And I don't know who the fourth person is.
No, you just named it. Isaac Cohen, who I would have never guessed, took 10 three-pointers last year and made four of them.
He's a man who picks his spots.
He certainly does. That's a fun team you guys have. I'm jealous.
So I do have a question that I'll kick to Sam. A question coming in from Mr. John Templin of NY Buckets. John wants to know, and with possibly a little bit of snark on this one, how could the Columbia defense possibly be passable this season? Any plans?
Well, I think that they're going to have to adopt a tendency that a lot of NBA teams have sort of gone to. They need to just find one guy who can protect the rim. And that might be impossible. That guy might not be on the roster, and they might have a horrific defense this year. But they need to find one person among Petrasek, Voss, Jeff Kobe, one of the freshmen maybe. Someone needs to just step in and be that guy who you are never going to throw the ball to on offense, but who is going to stand in the middle of your 2-3 zone or slough off a center in man-to-man and trust that Mauto Low and Kyle Castle are going to stay in front of their guys, and that when Grant Mullins and Alex Rosenberg don't, they're going to meet person X at the rim.
I have to say, my personal take on this is I do think Petrasek is actually the player who is most important to Columbia this year outside of the usual candidates. He showed his freshman year that he's willing to be violent at the rim. He's got crazy wingspan. He is very tall, but he blocks a lot of shots. And he does give you something offensively, which I don't think you can really say about Connor Voss, who looks like every time he gets a basketball, it's like he's never seen a basketball before in his life, which is sort of difficult. But if Petrasek can get in there, hold down that five, use his size, he's nearly 6'10", against the bigger bodies, then I think you're not in terrible shape, because Mauto Low is a very good defender, Kyle Castlin is a very good defender, and I think the other thing is, you touched on this, Kyle Smith is going to have to speed up this year. This team is good enough offensively, has a, you know, you're returning shooters, basically, that you didn't have last year, because Rosenberg and Mullins are just three-ball machines when they're on. Rosenberg gives you that driving potential. I think they'll try to play more possessions, because that's how you negate, you know, if you're a lockdown defense, you don't want a lot of possessions. But for Columbia, they're just going to want to try to outscore people. So we might have a pretty fun team in Lethia this year. Any final thoughts from the panel on Columbia?
Yeah, well, I was just going to add in real quick that our Ian Wendick had reported, and I don't know how long this will hold, that Kyle Smith plans to start Voss at center to begin with. So, you know, there's your, you know, makeshift solution for now, I guess. But
well, we're going to see how he holds up after Northwestern and Kansas State, which are the first two Division I games of the season. Because that is quite a fire to be thrown into for a guy who hasn't played more than like 5 minutes a game in his career. Yeah, and I saw Ian pump his fist that he's you going to that game next week?
I'm leaving Evanston that day, so I'm sadly gonna miss Columbia. But I did live up in Morningside Heights this past summer, and I ran into Kyle Smith at Chipotle, and had a nice conversation with him. He said his wife is a big reader of the site, so if you're listening, hi, Miss Smith.
Oh, yes, hi, Miss Smith. Hope you're doing well. All right, let's. Sam, do you have anything else?
Yeah, just one thing when I was looking up stuff for our very extensive Columbia preview this week.
That, you should go read, because it took us, like, weeks.
It's amazing.
Thorough, went a little bit thorough. Off the rails. A little bit off the rails. On a serious note, one of the things I looked up is that since Smith took over, the Lions have never been higher than sixth in Ivy play in terms of pace. That they last year they were seventh, the year before they were eighth. This is a slow-it-down team. And I think at the start of the season, especially with Rosenberg coming back from injury, they're probably not going to push it that much. But I think in Ivy play, that could be something that maybe in January they flip the switch on, because the back end of their non-conference schedule is pretty weak. So that might be the time where they start to try new things, like really pushing the tempo, playing some small ball, that sort of thing.
All right, so that deals with the three teams that got first place votes in the league. We're going to take a very quick break, play a little bit of music, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the three really interesting teams in the mid-pack, which are Brown, Penn, and Harvard.
You're listening to On the Vine, podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by IvyHoopsOnline.com.
All right, we are back here on the Vine, the podcast about Ivy League basketball, brought to you by IvyHoopsOnline.com. I'm Peter Andrews, joined tonight by Mike Tony, Ian Halpern, George Clark, and Sam Tidings. We're breaking down the Ivy League basketball season, which starts in earnest on Friday. One of the things we're looking out for is the debut of new Penn basketball head coach Steve Donahue, who was last seen being run out of Boston College on a set of rails. Before that, though, he was leading Cornell into the Sweet 16 in 2010. Start with Mike Tony, who covers Penn and has Penn connections and generally is useful for this sort of thing. Mike, your thoughts on the Donahue era, and I would like you to start by commenting on Tony Hicks mysteriously leaves the program.
Yes, so I do think that Tony Hicks mysteriously leaving the program, it's kind of a double-edged sword in that that was one of the most interesting storylines going into the season, is how is this, streaky, slashing guard who likes to just take over games and is either dropping 30 or disappearing. How is he going to fit into this very offensively efficient, analytics-friendly offensive system that Steve Donahue is instituting? And yeah, he's gone now. It seems like it was a situation where he felt uncomfortable. He wasn't going to, play his style of play, which was always more of a, isolation jumper slash drive oriented offense that maybe isn't meshing with what Donahue wants to do. If he's having people encourage him to take a year off and spend it elsewhere like other graduate transfers are doing, that's great for him. I do think it will eventually, especially long run, be a case of addition by subtraction, though. Because, you know, ever since I started covering Penn, this offense has been very undisciplined off the ball. A lot of standing around, letting Tony Hicks do something or Miles Jackson Cartwright do something. It was still a motion offense under Jerome Allen, but it was predicated on more kickouts, more analytics, unfriendly two-point jumpers. The strategy now with Steve Donahue is to get inside, draw fouls. If you can't do that, then shoot threes and defend those facets of the game on the other end of the floor, because this is a guy, Steve Donahue, who values offensive efficiency above all else. From a more macro perspective, it does feel great to be a Penn fan again, and that's fantastic, because there has been a clear cultural shift, in the Penn basketball program toward openly talking about strategies to reporters. I saw a tweet, Steve Donahue and his staff were visiting the Daily Pennsylvanian office, and that would have just been an unfathomable thing in the previous regime. It's kind of a surreal thing, but this is a guy who is open to helping freshmen move in. He's open to counting the numbers of hours that his players are sleeping at night, because he wants them to get 8 hours of sleep. This is a very different feel. It's an intangible shift, but it's a crucial one. And I think that, Antonio Woods talking about he's moving better off the ball now, I think he was quoted in the DP, and there's been a couple of pieces on our site that indicate the same thing, that this is going to be a situation where no one's standing still on offense. These are going to be better off-ball players. They're a closer team. This seems to be a closer-knit team, and that's crucial. I think the intangible feeling is back that Penn is going to be good in the future, and I think that it's going to pay instant dividends on the offensive side of the floor. I don't think this is going to be a team that is in the basement of the conference along with Cornell. I think they'll be more toward the middle of the pack. You're going to see Jake Silpe start right away, the freshman of the year candidate. Good vibes at Penn again, and it's been a while.
I mean, good vibes.
Michael, I agree with that.
They're also going to be, they're not in title contention. So, sorry, George, I cut you off. What's your opinion here?
My opinion is that Michael has hit the nail on the head as far as the intangibles, and you can't, to me, I don't think you can overestimate the intangibles. It's not a perfect analogy by any means, but the change in athletic administration and the football coach at Michigan really turned the culture around and brought the culture of Michigan back. And I think in that sense, Steve Donahue going back to the University of Pennsylvania is quite kind of the same thing. He really loves that job. He really loves that program. He loves that building. And as Michael suggested, it's fun to be a Penn fan again. That you can't overestimate or overstate the importance of that cultural shift. And the fact that Hicks has left is more than addition by subtraction. It's probably a very, very, very good thing, because their expectations are not that great this year. And you don't have to deal with Tony Hicks' distractions, which unfortunately were very un-Ivy League-like. And they were really sad to see at times. And Jerome Allen was as great a player as I've ever seen. But what went on there was really, toward the end, it was clearly time for a change. And I think they made the right change. And Princeton's always had trouble dealing with with Nelson Henry, so anything can happen. When he's on the floor against us, we just haven't been able to stop him. So I think Penn could very easily rise as high as fifth, possibly even fourth in the league. But they're going to be a team that'll give a lot of people problems by the end of the year.
Yeah, it's going to be a mediocre season, but as the ancient Quaker said, I don't think Quaker fans have ever been so excited to have a mediocre season upcoming.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's a pretty convincing, in my mind, counter-argument, which is that the Penn basketball team wasn't very good last year because they had a bad coach, but also because they don't have a lot of great players, and the addition of a new coach is probably not going to be enough to turn that around very quickly. And Tony Hicks, I will miss the annual Tony Hicks Memorial suspension, but he was a good basketball player, and I will miss him on the court, at least at first. I don't doubt that Penn has a better long-term prognosis for years 2, 3, 4. I don't see it this year. I don't see them seriously contending for the top division. And I wanna move on to Brown, because I know that Ian can only be here for a certain length of time, and Ian is our Brown University expert. So I'm going to start with this question for you, which has been kicking around in my head. Is Mike Martin on the hot seat this year in Providence?
So it's a good question. There's been a lot of mediocre finishes if you just look at the standings. This is Martin getting his first class all the way through. So Quakamensis is a senior. This is his team. I think there's some like quiet optimism in Providence, but it does seem like this Brown team is a notch below where those top three contenders are. It seems to me like their ceiling this year, with all these young guys that they have coming in, is to be that last team in the top half. And honestly, I think that's going to be tough to do given just the program that Harvard has. So I think we've reached the part of this show where we're talking about teams whose ceiling is mid standings. So I don't mean to start on a depressing note, but besides Kwakupensa, it's going to be tough for Brown to replace that front court production. They're small. Rebounding is going to be a real issue. But if you do look at the backcourt, if you look at the wing, you got Spieth, you got Hobby, you have some shooters, definitely some guys who can score. I want to talk about Justin Massey, whose brother Jason was a freshman on the team last year. Justin has transferred from Florida Atlantic. I know that some people in the program are really excited about him. I think he's going to start at the two, Justin Massey. So that's exciting. It sounds like he's an all-around scorer. Haven't gotten the chance to see him yet, but excited to see what he can do. And then besides that, you have Tavon Blackman at the point for his junior season. This is a team that's proved that they can. I feel like every year Brown has that game with Harvard where it goes to double overtime, or that they kind of overachieve in spurts, and then they have bad losses, and then they end up somewhere around 5-9. And hopefully Martin can do something to bring these young guys along quickly. But I think it's going to be a challenge, and I think with this front court, there's a kid named, I think it's Travis Fuller. 6'9" freshman who's going to have a chance to play alongside Kwakupensa a lot. A lot depends on how quickly he and Justin Massey can adjust in non-conference to see if they can be really competitive once the Ivy season rolls around.
And I asked specifically about Martin is because there have been sort of suggestions of discontent within the program. You had the kind of not so great departure of Leland King in the middle of last season. Do you think that's smoke matching fire, or do you think that that was a distinct situation?
What
in your mind qualifies as a good season for Brown versus what in your mind qualifies as they have to start thinking about restarting the program?
So I don't sense the urgency in Providence or around the program to suggest that a disastrous season here for Martin would result in the end of his time there. I would actually be pretty surprised, even if they finish 7th or 8th, to see him go. I think he has a longer leash there. That said, the clock is ticking. We haven't seen much improvement from the program, and at some point it has to turn around. For me right now, I think that end of the line is probably 2 to 3 years out and not here this year. And if he can put up a fifth or a sixth place finish, show some improvement, you know, have the young guys come along, one or two notable wins, I think that'll be enough to give him more chances to get some marquee guys into the program.
So the rest of the panel, any thoughts about Brown or questions you have for Ian, who knows a lot more about Brown than I do?
I'm just excited to see Cedric Kwakumensa play. He's a really entertaining player to watch, and this year I think we're going to see more of his offensive acumen, what he can do on that side of the floor. I'm just a big Cedric Kwakumensa fan and have been ever since he almost took my head off throwing an errant pass toward press row. The press row is like right on the court at the Pizzatola. So, I'm just a big Kwakumensa guy, and I don't think that they're going to be, you know, a upper echelon Ivy, but hopefully if they can get a couple of upsets of those top three, that would bring further legitimacy to a program that could, you know, use a boost this season.
Definitely. Kwakumensa is one of the, you know, best defensive players, if not the best defensive player in the Ivy League. Most block shots in Brown history, 17 block shots away from the new Ivy League career record. Barring an injury, he'll be the block king of the Ivy League after this season. So definitely an exciting player. Looking forward to seeing what he can do in his final season in Providence.
All right, so I think that pretty well covers the Brown Bears. The next place I want to go is, it's very strange to be 45 minutes into an Ivy League basketball preview show and not to have mentioned the Harvard Crimson. But I think it's more than warranted in this specific instance. Missing from last year's, and we're going to say goodbye to Ian Halpern right now. Ian, thanks so much for joining us tonight. It was really great.
Happy to sign off right before Harvard, just as a Harvard painter. Just kidding. All right, thanks, guys. A lot of fun.
Take care, Ian.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you, Ian.
So, for Harvard, no Wesley Saunders, no Steve Mondumacy. After an unfortunate ACL injury suffered in September, no Siani Chambers. Harvard has been in the NCAA tournament 4 straight years. It looks like that streak will end this year. I guess my first question for the panel is, does anyone see a scenario in which Harvard wins the league?
No. Yeah. No, I do not. I think it was interesting that in the SI list, they were listed above Yale. The SI ranking of the 351 college basketball teams listed Yale 4th in the Ivy below Harvard. And that's got to really tick off fans in New Haven and the like. But no, I don't see that. Yes, to quickly answer your question, no, I don't see that happening.
Shrugs of agreements that is impossible from George and Sam on the video chat here. What's the question for Harvard is, what is the goal for this year? Are we trying to see the emergence of the next great piece? Who do we think that's going to be? And I guess, how does Tommy Amaker deal with not playing from ahead?
Go ahead, George. Is this young McCarthy kid is going to have to play where Siani Chambers was slated to play. I think with the recruiting class that is coming in next year, I think Amaker's responsibility or his mission this year really is to develop a lot of quality contributors in preparation for next year. And Harvard has plenty of talent to compete. They maybe not. Maybe they won't reach the top three this year, but on any given night, they're going to be a tough team to handle. It's just that Zeno is finally going to play a lot. He's going to have to play a lot, and he's had a pretty good preseason from what I've heard so far, that he's ready to go. So Harvard is going to compete. they're just not going to be able to go 10-4 this year.
Yeah, the word I've gotten from people that have covered Harvard is they're really looking to Andre Chatfield now as a sophomore stepping up, similar to the career progression of Wesley Saunders, where he had a kind of neither here nor there freshman year and then just exploded as a sophomore to the Wesley Saunders that we now know. You know, he's apparently had a bit of an ankle injury, but I have heard that he should be okay for the start of the season. But, you know, you look at these replacements for particularly Siani Chambers, Matt Fraschilla, Corbin Miller. You've got guys who, you know, haven't taken the ball up the court a whole lot, and particularly in an intense game in Ivy League play. You know, I don't know if you're really heavily relying on people like McCarthy and Chatfield, question marks like that don't bode too well. If you look at the seniors, you've got Ogunwa Okali, Evan Cummins. These guys aren't going to give you any offense. In the front court, you know, you've really got a team that has been substantially weakened. They won 66-63 over McGill in an exhibition game that was a bit too close for comfort this week. So you do have Zena and the power of Zena there in the front court. Hopefully he can, as a junior, make that leap. But otherwise, the defense might be there, but, you know, if anyone says they know where the offense is coming from at this point outside of the program, they're lying, because it's a roster full of question marks.
Yeah, I think that Harvard's goal between today and when we do the season preview on the Vine a year from now is they need to have identified the four guys who are going to run with Siani Chambers when he returns. So between this year's freshman class, next year's top 10 nationally ranked recruiting class, I follow Michael James on Twitter, and he's talking about this recruiting class, and I'm like, you know, surely he's just propping it up a little bit. And I went and looked a couple weeks ago, and Tommy Emmerich is bringing in 4- and 5-star guys to come play at Harvard for next season, for the 2016-17 season. So if this is their down year, it might be their only down year for a while. So Amaker needs to figure out between now and the start of next season, do I have 4 other guys I can roll with starting 5 currently in the team? Are they going to have to be among next year's freshmen? What can we do so that when Siani Chambers comes back over the summer or in the fall next year, that we're ready to go win an Ivy title? Aside from that, Yale twice this year, I think that's a good enough thing for them.
All right, so a very different outlook for a Harvard team that has really bedeviled the rest of the league over the last 4 or 5 years. I, for one, have made my opinions on Harvard very well known in basically any form of media in which someone will listen to me, which is an increasingly small amount of media, but I am personally very much enjoying not Siani Chambers being injured, because I think that's too bad, but he is very annoying, but he's a good basketball player. But you never want to see guys missing out due to injury. That being said, it doesn't really make me particularly upset that Harvard is not going to be at the top of the league this year. More or less.
Is absolutely right, Peter. Enjoy it while you can.
Yes.
Exactly. All right, so we have got 6 minutes left in the show. We've got 2 more teams to talk about, so we're going to do this rapid-fire style. We're going to talk about Cornell, and we're going to talk about Dartmouth. So each of you gets, 2 sentences to talk about each of these teams. Let's start with Dartmouth, my 2 sentences. This team was a real surprise last year, and I have to give Paul Cormier a lot of credit for what he did. However, I don't think there's enough talent in Hanover, and I also thought it was malarkey that Miles Wright was named Rookie of the Year.
I'll agree with that. I think it should have been Kyle Castlin. I'm sure you do, too. But the defense is not the issue with Dartmouth, and you'd rather have a good defense than a good offense. But having said that, I don't know. We need to see a full season of Miles Wright, taking the reins there, and You know, I don't know. Well, there's a lot of question marks on that team. Malik Gill was very exciting. But, you know, where the offensive production is going to come from puts them somewhat in the same boat as Harvard. We'll just have to wait and see.
I think, since only a two sentences, number one is I think that Dartmouth finishes fourth this year and that they go back to the postseason.
Bold prediction from Sam Tidings. George.
I'm not sure I can agree with either one of you. I think Dartmouth is probably going to be a little bit better than you think, Peter, but I don't think they're fourth. I think Cormier does a great job. I think you might not like Miles Wright, but if he's as good as Castle or close, he's going to be a real good player up there. And they've got some pieces coming back, but losing the guard, the point guard, he's not. Gill is not. He's too undersized. He's good for stretches, but he's not going to carry that team.
And Mottola is a huge loss for them, and I was shocked to hear it. I'm sure Cormier was counting on him this year. Let me be clear. I actually think Dartmouth is a perfectly fine 5 or 6 candidate because I'm not very high on Brown or. Penn, and I'm not really on Cornell. And let's talk about Cornell very quickly. Cornell, as per usual, a ton of question marks. No Sean Miller this year as he's moved on. We're taking a look at a team that's going to be led by Robert Hatter, who as a, flops more than your average Brazilian soccer player on the court. I'm not a fan of his game at all. I don't think this team has a lot to look forward to, and I think that the best you can say is that Bill Courtney's probably gone at the end of the season.
Yeah, I think Cornell this season is in the same spot as Penn was last season in that you're starting over with a cupboard that's pretty bare roster-wise, and you've got a coach that seems to be very much in a lame duck situation. And Bill Courtney's up-tempo style may not work with a young team that is as likely undisciplined as this one's going to be. Robert Hatter's usage is going to skyrocket, but otherwise, I don't see where the success is going to come from.
I have a tough time projecting Cornell with more than 3 wins in the league. Really, I think without Sean Miller, whatever shot at legitimacy they had or relevance went to Connecticut with him.
I think that they win 5 games as a season this year. Like, I have the end on conference. Considering how much of an upgrade that would be for them, that might be the goal they need to aspire to. I think the best case scenario for them is really just playing spoiler to one of Columbia, Princeton, Yale, and winning 1 or 2 of those 6 games and just ruining someone's season. Like, we would have won the title, but we lost to Cornell,
And let's be clear, if you lose to Cornell, you don't deserve to win the title. That just about does it for the season preview on the Vine. I do want to say we try to give more or less equal time to everyone, at least before the season has really sorted itself out. We'll get Dartmouth and Cornell people on the show as we go along, I'm sure. How this is going to work going forward, we haven't quite figured it out. I now live in California, and I've got a lot of other stuff going on, so we might have episodes of the show where it's just Mike taking the reins, but you can be sure that there'll be a good helping of On the Vine as we move through this very exciting, wide-open Ivy League basketball campaign. I want to say thank you to Ian Halpern, who left early. Always great to hear from him. Always great to hear from Sam Tidings as well. Sam, thank you so much for booting up your computer and joining us.
Thank you, and my 2008 Dell Inspiron thanks you.
It's always good to see George Clark again. Last time I actually talked to George, I think it was in person at the at Jadwin. It's good to see you again, and good luck to your Tigers this year.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to see you, and that particular night was the motto low night at Jadwin. I'll never forget it, and if we have to look at him for 37 again some night, we're not going to beat him this time. But I'm looking forward to a tremendous season. It's great to see all of you, and I can't wait to get started.
And as always, to the Generalissimo of IvyHoopsOnline.com, Mike Tony, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Peter. Me trying to helm future shows would be like Ed McMahon taking over for Johnny. person. I'll try to do what I can, but hats off to you and Sam and Miles and Ian for all your great Columbia coverage, and it's great to be back on the Vine again.
And with 5 seconds left, that'll do it for us. Have a good night, everyone. See you around.